Hey folks, Scott Weingart here. This is an edited version of an interview I did with Paul Marek. It was edited primarily with some stuff added at the end. So if you've heard it and just want to hear the edits, then skip to 13 minutes and 3 seconds, and you'll be able to hear what's changed. Let's get into the original interview, and then at the end you'll hear the edits I added for clarification. The timing of this week was kind of forced by the recent media blitz about the metabolic resuscitation of sepsis, or the sepsis cocktail, as I've been referring to it, put forth from the ICU of friend to the show, Paul Marek. And we had got an advance notice. The folks at MCRIT had been mulling this over for a few weeks now, and I had a interview planned with Paul in the future, but there's been after a press release, this insane media attention to this therapy. And since Josh's post was just put up on MCRIT, and if you have no idea what I'm talking about with this, what the hell is the metabolic resuscitation of sepsis, then just read Josh's post. It's at the top of MCRIT right now, and you'll be able to understand, and this whole interview will make more sense. But over the past few days, there's been a lay press concentration on this, and I figured I'd just get Paul on the phone now to talk about this, because I think all of you have questions in your head about what to do with this today. And I'll discuss briefly where I think you should go. The foreshadowing of that is I don't have an answer for you at the end of the show. But let's get right to it. Interview with Paul Marek on the metabolic resuscitation of sepsis. How are you?
Good, yourself.
Excellent. So, yeah, wow, things blew up, eh?
Yeah, I was not expecting this. It's been kind of chaotic, which I suppose is good in a way, actually. You know, it's almost, university has been really positive. There are the... You know, the Derek Angus Mervyn Singers of the world who think this is bullshit, you know, that you need a multi-center randomized trial. But you know what? It's like jumping out of an airplane with or without a parachute. You know, you don't need to do a big randomized study. And that if you just treat patients, you see it. And you have nothing to lose. You know, even if you think it's bullshit, you know, what have you got to lose? And the other thing which I don't think they recognize is that, you know, we didn't just suck this out of thin air. There's an enormous amount of basic science, preclinical and clinical data to support this.
Yeah, well, that's my first question to you, Paul, is how did it come to this particular cocktail? What was the mental path that you walked?
Yeah, so I kind of started off based on Dr. Fowler at VCU. Has been using vitamin C to treat ALDS, and he used two doses, 50 milligrams per kilogram and then 200 milligrams per kilogram. So when we started off, we thought we'd take the middle road and use 100 milligrams per kilogram. But then we kind of figured out many of our patients were quite obese and we were giving them really quite big doses. And then we figured out that it's water soluble, so it really doesn't distribute in the fat compartment. So then that's kind of when we settled on the 1.5 gram dose. We kind of looked at the procalcitonin kinetics is actually quite interesting. And we found that we think like 1.5 is probably around about the right dose, but you know, clearly we need to do more studies. But that's how we came to the 1.5. The steroid we use, you know, the standard dose, which people are recommending now, you know, stress response, which was 200 twice a day. The thiamine, we based it on a paper in Critical Care Medicine called, I think it's called Unpeeling the Banana Bag, in which they suggest that the standard dose of 100 milligrams of thiamine is much too low and one should use at least 200 to 500 twice a day. So that's how we kind of came up with this concoction, this cocktail. The thiamine actually we added after the second or third patient after reading about vitamin C and its metabolism. And it so happens that if you're thiamine deficient, it increases oxalate levels. And then there have been studies showing that thiamine actually improves the outcome of sepsis. And as you know, many of our patients are elderly with not great intake, so we figured they're probably thiamine deficient. So at first, I wasn't sure what role Flamme actually played. But, you know, I think it's part of the cocktail that, you know, people are trying to say, dissect it out. And I think, you know, it's a cocktail. You know, the same way as when you give chemotherapy, you give CHOP or whatever it is, and you give a combination. This is a combination that works. So what we did do, which I think is really cool and gives it enormous validity, is our fellow took this to the lab with Dr. Katravis, who has an interest in vascular biology, and he exposes pulmonary endothelial monolayer cells to endotoxin, which obviously kills the cell. When we gave vitamin C and hydrocortisone separately, it didn't have an effect, but the combination actually protected the monolayer against endotoxin. So it kind of, in a very objective, controlled environment, you know, kind of proved what we were seeing in the ICU.
That's amazing. Now, Paul, regardless of anything you or I say, people are going to start trying this today. And that might be a good thing. It might be a bad thing. Let's not dwell on that. If they are going to start doing this on their patients, is there any things they need to be aware of? Are there any patient groups this isn't appropriate in, from your opinion? Is there any little tricks of the trade to making this work?
Yeah, so obviously, the sooner you start, the better. I mean, I think it's like antibiotics, that the sooner you start, the better. You know, we've been monitoring for potential side effects. The only patient group I wouldn't do it in is patients with kidney stones. I think that's the only potential group of patients, just because of the problem of oxalate. But you know what? I can't tell you for sure. So oxalate excretion will increase. But on the other hand, you could argue if you have a kidney stone and you're dying from urosepsis, you know, what do you have to lose? So that's the only potential contraindication. The other, which we thought about, was sickle cell disease, because many of these patients have concomitant G6PD deficiency. So it's interesting, with G6PD deficiency, low-dose vitamin C may be helpful. High dose may be harmful. So I think if you have a sickle patient, you may just want to watch them for evidence of hemolysis, but it doesn't seem to be an issue.
How long do you continue it? And is there a weaning, or do you just stop when the patient gets better?
Yeah, so we did 4 days, which was basically what Dr. Fowler did. And so what we do is 4 days or until they leave the ICU. Most patients leave the ICU on the third day. We've never had a patient who actually had to treat for more than 4 days. So we treated for 4 days or until they leave the ICU. As I said, you know, patients come into the unit in septic shock and they leave on the third day, which is quite remarkable. So, you know, I think 4 days generally is fine. I've been contacted by a patient who's been on a ventilator in septic shock for 5 weeks now, and they wanted my advice. And I said, you know, obviously this is uncharted territory, and they want to know how long should we treat for. I said, you know, that's a really difficult question to answer. I think it's safe. I would just, you know, give it for maybe up to 6 or 7 days, but just follow the patient closely. But as a rule, you know, we've been following, you know, what Dr. Fowler did, and have been doing it for 4 days.
How sick does the patient need to be included in this protocol if you were doing it at the bedside? Is this for only septic shock by whatever definition you're using today? Is it a patient already at severe sepsis but not septic shock using the current U.S. government definitions? What do you think is the right group for this, Paul?
Yeah, so you ask a good question. So when we started doing this, we weren't sure. So we were doing it in patients who had severe sepsis, septic shock coming to ICU. So they had to be really sick. But, you know, once we started to see the, you know, remarkable turnaround, we actually now, any patient who's sick enough to come to the ICU, you know, we will treat, you know, because obviously if they're going to come to the ICU, they have risk of progressive organ failure or death. But, you know, people have asked me, well, what about on the floor? And, you know, my answer is we don't know. And maybe it has a role. I think its role really is in patients who are at risk of organ failure and further decline. if the patient has an uncomplicated UTI, it probably is not going to be of benefit. But I think if they have severe urosepsis, then they would benefit. So that would be my answer.
Fantastic. Last question, because I want to be cognizant of your time, Paul. If people start adopting this now, is there any trepidation that it would actually lead IRBs to make it difficult to actually perform the RCT? I'm very hesitant when these new therapies start that they become a standard of care before there's, you know, real multi-center testing, and it becomes very difficult to do those studies because people are already doing it.
Hey, Scott, you ask the million-dollar question, which is just so difficult to answer. You know, that was what I was grappling with doing an RCT here, you know, because, you know, is it ethical to do one? And, you know, my feeling was here we couldn't do one, but it would have to be done at somewhere, at another center where it's not the standard of care. So I suppose, you know, it depends how this gets adopted. You know, if it becomes usual care, then it becomes more difficult to do an RCT. So it is a difficult question to answer. You know, unfortunately, the skeptics, you know, want a large multi-center randomized study, you know, before they'll believe anything. You know, that's difficult to do. It takes a lot of time. I know that there are probably about 20 centers now that are doing this and are, you know, collecting observational data. You know, whether that will satisfy the critics, you know, I'm not sure.
Well, Paul, I can't thank you enough. I'm sure we'll all be hearing far more about this in the coming weeks. And thank you for your time.
No, thanks, Scott. It's always a wonderful pleasure.
Okay, folks, there you go. And there's going to be more to come on this, I am sure, both on MCRIT and off. If you want to hear more, well, actually, if you want to read more, go to Josh's post on this. It's at the top of MCRIT right now on the metabolic resuscitation of sepsis. And in there is linked everything else currently on the web discussing this. So you can find a lot more information there. The question you may have, the question I have is, should I be doing this today or should I wait for more evidence? As to my opinion, I don't know yet. I really have to give this a good think. And it probably won't matter what I think. I have to sit down with the people at my hospital and have a good collective think, because me starting this and then it not being continued is worthless. So I think that's what you should do as well, is sit down with all the folks that are stakeholders in the treatment of sepsis patients at your hospital and decide, what do you think? Should we do this? If so, who should we do it on? Should we not? Should we wait for an RCT? And play it that way, because I think that's the only effective way of handling new evidence emerging without, top EBM hierarchy evidence.
Hey, folks, this is the edited portion of the podcast. So after I released the original interview last night, I got an email from a good friend. And in essence, what he said is, hey, idiot, it sounds like you're endorsing this therapy. Is that really what you're doing? And when I released the interview, in my mind, it was in the context of the PulmCrit post, so people would have a balanced and objective assessment of what's actually being said here, and the interview in my mind was just a tag onto that. But people may be listening to this independently, and as such, I should make abundantly clear certain things. First of all, this is low-level evidence. A before and after trial should not be regarded as anything close to definitive. It would not surprise me in the least if, when this was studied in a RCT fashion, preferably a multi-center RCT, that there was zero benefit. That wouldn't surprise me. And in fact, based on the track record of this stuff, it probably is the more likely possibility. So that, bear that in mind, first of all. And then that just went without saying in my head, but it probably shouldn't go without saying. So there we go. We've said that. Before and after trials are notorious for showing benefit, because when they don't show benefit, they're never published. And then when they're actually studied in a more rigorous fashion, all of the benefit or most of the benefit disappears. So bear that in mind first. The other part of what my friend said is, why didn't you ask Paul the hard questions? And that's a very valid point. When I was doing this interview, it was from the mindset of
pure curiosity. I just wanted to figure out what was going through Paul's head. And it didn't even seem time for the hard questions yet, because this is such a nascent stage for this treatment.
But my friend's point is it's quite valid. So I'm going to ask Paul the hard questions. The question I'm going to ask Paul is, Paul, you've made a career out of busting myths in critical care. You've gone after so many topics where there's been poor evidence or no evidence, and you've pointed it out to the people involved. So the question I have is, if you saw this paper without you being the author, would you be supporting it, or would you be tearing down anyone using this therapy at this point because of the early stage on the evidence hierarchy? And so I'm sure Paul will answer, knowing Paul, but you probably have tough questions you want me to pose to Paul. And I probably should have posed harder ones. So let's remedy that. Send me whatever tough questions you want me to put to Dr. Marek, and I'll send him his way, and we'll either get him to respond in writing or we'll get him to respond on the show. All right, enough of that. Let me know what you think. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.